beginning to flow. I felt the beat of my mind go drifting into time passages. Yes, go falling in the fading light, time passages. Buy me a ticket on the last train home tonight.
Welcome back to Mid-Mornings on Main. That is Al Stewart and Time Passages. So we're gonna do some passaging. We're going to talk about a new novel that is out with the writer, P.K. Edgewater, who joins us from out in Oregon. The book is called Passages, A Voyage from War to Peace. And P.K., good morning. Welcome. Thanks for getting up early to join us.
Good morning, Dan. Yeah. You know, you're killing me. It's 0600 over here. But I really appreciate you bringing me on.
Hey, it's I always said if I were going to try to, you know, drop off the grid, so to speak, and so that nobody would find me, that where I would go, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, North Dakota maybe, or oh, go Southern Utah, that might be a place, but I always thought Eastern Oregon would be a great place to drop off the grid, you know, because if I'm, would that be okay? You think I could be lost there in Eastern Oregon?
Oh yeah. You could get lost in any place in Oregon. You could get lost in Portland.
Oh no.
Eastern Oregon is a mountainous area, lakes, rivers, the West Coast here, where I am. It's just beautiful. The forest just rocks right up to the ocean, and it's beautiful.
Have you been in Oregon for a long time?
I have been in Oregon for about 5.5 years. I spent most of my medical career in Arizona, and before that, Chicago, and before that, Cleveland.
Oh, you were working your way west.
I was.
And you found the best. I always figured if people, you know, if I disappeared from Kentucky today and people started saying, wonder where we could find him, you know, they'd be looking across the map and they'd be saying, yeah, I wonder if he'd be in Oregon. Nah, nobody would go to Oregon. He wouldn't go out there. Oregon's the middle of nowhere. Why would you go to Oregon? It is a little bit. I mean, what is it? What is special about Oregon?
Well, mostly what I've already mentioned: the mountains, the forests, the coastline, the rivers. There are some wide open spaces, but everywhere you turn, the view is beautiful. I'm sure you have that in Kentucky as well. I'm a little biased. I spent 34 years in the desert of Phoenix, Arizona, and you know, my wife and I just wanted to have a real change. So we came up here to the Pacific Northwest, and we're in a home that's right along the coast. I'm looking out my window. Well, when the sun comes up, I'll be looking at the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, wow.
And we are surrounded by tall Sitka spruce, and it's just very pleasant.
You found paradise. You found your paradise.
I think so. And more than that, I've lived a city life virtually all of my professional career. And now I'm in a rural coastal area. And I came here with intention to learn how people live in this environment. And it's such a revelation. I'm an old guy. I'm retired from my core profession, but I'm still learning so much, and I'm learning from the people around me, and it's just a great journey.
Well, there's a great thought for, I think, anybody. I don't really want to move from Kentucky. I like the change of seasons. Yeah. I tell people all the time, the only thing I want to do is retire so that when there's a lot of ice and snow on, I can sit in front of my fireplace and read a good book and watch a good movie and let my wife bring me food in the easy chair if I want to. The dog can sit in my lap, and I don't have to go out if I don't want to when the weather's cold. And then, but I get all the seasons too. But the idea of saying when I move somewhere, you know, I'm going to move away with the intent of discovering the people. How do people live here? What's the lifestyle? Yeah. That's a thought that not a lot of people, I think, probably move to an area with.
Well, first of all, I think you've got the right idea about retirement. You've got the right idea. I think you're going to have a little withdrawal, however, having done what you do so well for so many decades. You'll miss it. But even with your dog in your lap and by that fireplace and reading a good book, you'll be drawn to the adventure that you're still having right now. But yeah, for me, life is an adventure, and most of the adventure, as you put it, are the people in front of you and understanding how they live, what's their motivation, what stresses them, and how do they react to that stress, how do they deal with it. So life is rich when you're surrounded by people.
Here's the million-dollar question. PK, are you going to tell us what PK stands for?
I can, if it's important. It's Paul Kelly.
Okay. That's kind of stuff. I thought, boy, it must be something really kind of odd for him.
Sounds like chemistry, doesn't it?
Yeah, PK, you know. Back here in the old days, you'd have been a preacher's kid.
Is that right?
If you called you PK. So? PK, preacher's kid. PK. That's what that. Oh, that's a PK over there.
Pretty creative.
Yeah, that's a PK. Growing up, you had siblings. Where was that growing up home place?
So that growing up home place was Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh, you know,
right in the middle of America.
I've been to Tulsa. And I flew into Tulsa one night. I'd been on the ground in St. Louis, and the airplane, they were trying to get it de-iced.
Yeah.
Which always makes you feel really, oh boy, can't wait to take off.
Good luck with that.
And when we landed, and we finally landed in Tulsa at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and there was ice on the runway, and we went, we had a safe landing, and it was fine. And we were going to Oral Roberts University for a basketball game. And that was when ORU was, you know, kind of in the spotlight. Oral Roberts was building that place at the time. And but Tulsa was a good place to grow up, I would think.
It was a good place. You know, like you said, it has the four seasons that we all enjoyed. You know, we didn't regret anything. We looked forward to the next season, what sports are coming up and what the weather is going to be like and how we're going to play and go to school. Yeah, it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah. Was the medical profession always in your mindset fairly early?
It was. I can't recall the exact origin, but I liked the life sciences, and I really had a boost in that interest early in college. I was in a military school, and there was a Fulbright colonel who got me interested in life sciences, and so that's where the trajectory really began.
Was that at the Air Force Academy?
It was.
Yeah. Oh, what a great place to go to school. I mean, to get an appointment to the Air Force Academy, wow, that's a big deal. You had to be a great student. You had to do a lot of extracurricular things. But to be one of six siblings, is that right? Six?
That's right.
Yeah, you know, and you were the last one, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh.
I was the baby of the family. I hated it when my mother said that.
What a gift you gave your parents. They, you're the last one to come on. Oh, we don't have to pay for school again. We're done. The Air Force is going to take. And
that was a huge blessing. Yeah.
And Colorado Springs, what a place to be in, right?
It is. Yeah. It is very nice.
I have a nephew who for 10 years taught, or he coached the U.S. Paralympic swim team that did all of their training there at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
And the big training center.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, is there a place called Garden of the Gods?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And isn't that a beautiful
right outside the academy
area? And then and then I'm sure you ran up Pike's Peak several times.
You give me too much credit.
I got halfway up in a car and said, I'm thinking that's far enough. I can see the top. Let me turn it. Listen, can I get this thing turned around and go back down? I don't need any more of this. I'm good.
It's high up there.
What did you do in the Air Force?
You know, frankly, I spent my time as a cadet. I was there for the first 2 years, and during that time, I had a great run, and I was on the wrestling team. I made the commandant's list and the superintendent's list, and I was all ready to go, and then one after another, I was informed that I was not pilot qualified because of vision, and then I was informed subsequently that I was not navigator qualified because I have an element of color blindness. Go figure that.
They're getting really picky, aren't they?
I tell you what, they had so much good material that if you had any, you know, deficiencies, you were in the targets. So as I mentioned, I got really interested in a pathway to medicine inspired by this colonel. And so after 2 years and our withdrawing from Vietnam, I posted away from the Air Force Academy and made a beeline for medical school.
And where was medical school?
Oklahoma State University, right in Tulsa.
And Oklahoma State University in Tulsa?
Yes. Well, the medical campus is
the medical campus.
The main campus is in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
And Boone Pickens, wow, did he do a job for Oklahoma State down on the Stillwater campus?
Yeah.
That was phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
What they have done down there.
He did a great contribution to that institution. It's enduring.
Medical school. Did you know going into medical school what you wanted to kind of specialize in?
No, thank God. I went into medical school with eyes wide open, with the attitude of a generalist. And I just wanted to learn as much as I could and let the experience carry me wherever it was meant to carry me.
And where did it
eventually?
Yeah, where did it carry you?
I determined that as much as I liked being in the operating room, I liked more talking to people and working on difficult medical diagnoses. So I became an internist through residency. An internal medicine specialist is basically adult general medicine. And you have to learn about all the organ systems and all the physiology and all the pathology and all the pharmacology that it takes to take care of adults. And as I was getting through that phase of my training, I fell in love with the subspecialty of rheumatic and immunologic diseases. Those disorders that are born of an aberrant immune system. Primarily that start doing damage to people. You've probably heard of things like systemic lupus erythematosus, polymyositis, vasculitis, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis. These things that, you know, our immune system was built to protect us. But sometimes things go awry and cause inflammation in various organs, and it can be devastating and deadly.
Oh, if you have, if you have a month, you need to give back to the medical profession every year, just to give back to what kind of helped make you. There's a clinic here. We'll set you up. You can come for a month, and we'll just we'll roll them in one right after the other here. To see you, and you can help with the diagnosis. I had you. Did you watch a lot of MASH on television?
I did.
Well, see, I had you pictured PK as you were Dr. I think it was a major, Sidney Friedman, the psychiatrist.
Oh my gosh.
The psychiatrist who came and you know how the mind plays games. You know, I've got you. First, I've got this is almost like a real book, no, not a not a novel. And then, so I put you in the place and of the psychiatrist. You know, you are you are Miko, and then as you become a psychiatrist, you're Sidney Friedman. That's how you are pictured.
Well, that's a compliment. I thought that character he played was just marvelous.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a clinical psychologist. But in the book, you know, his general internship experiences, you know, sort of were born of my own experiences many decades ago. And, you know, the people I took care of, many of them, I took care of for years, and some for decades. And when you have a long experience with patients, you get very close. And I sort of gathered a clinical psychology acumen to help address those psychologic issues that had to do with people getting hammered by diseases that they don't deserve. The suffering that comes from it, the disability that comes from it, the life changes, the changes in the relationships. So I had enough aggregated experience and continuing education to sort of step into the eyes of this psychiatrist I created as a composite of many doctors that I met in training and during my career. Mm. So. That's not me, but it's a collage.
But close. Oh, well, if I was going to introduce you at a book signing, I think I would say, and here is Dr. P.K. Edgewater, a clinical expert in the field of medicine, but a wannabe psychiatrist.
you'd be close on.
How did you get the idea for the beginning, which turns out to be the ending as well, the beginning of the book? How did that begin to formulate in your mind? It's a bit of a stretch, I think. Have you traveled to Greece and to that area?
I have. I didn't spend much time there, but. Yes, and if you've read the book, you know that there's sort of a metaphysical quirk that ties the beginning to the end, and it has to do with certain hardware. I'm trying not to give spoilers to people who want to read the book, but it was a nice way to tidy things up, and I've had lots of experience. In practice with international medical graduates. As a matter of fact, in my group in Phoenix, we had several international medical graduates, and it really infused our group with a broader experience and broader viewpoint. that we all took advantage of.
I am right. It is M-I-K-O. It is Miko. Is it pronounced Miko, mm-hmm. or yeah. am I wrong?
Miko, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's a popular name there.
Yeah.
The Greek names I picked were simple and popular.
Simple and popular.
Miko, Kostas, Bia, Sophia.
Yeah. In terms of what's best about the book, what did I enjoy the most? Well, I do have to say that the prologue to the book, it draws you in. It's a little bit longer than a lot of prologues. It's a little bit longer than a lot of prologues are, but by the time I finished it, it wasn't the 59 pages of James Mitchell you got to read to get before you even kind of get into it at all. But it really does. I thought, boy, if you could get everybody into a bookstore, they get handed a copy of this book, put into a little reading room and say, don't come out until you finish the prologue. When they finish the prologue, they're going to come out and they're going to stick the book in their little book bag, because when they check out, they're going to be buying the book because it's going to draw them in. So the prologue is really good. And how important, and how long did the prologue come before you wrote anything else?
You know, in doing my research, I wrote certain things, particularly the combat scenes. I kind of wrote in real time as I was gathering the information. The prologue sort of formulated as I was trying to construct the plot from beginning to end, using the mechanisms that I did for the plot. And it was just a natural thing, and I think it lays the groundwork for the tone of the book, and just the exploration of relationships, which the book is about. It's really an exploration of relationships and the transitions in the relationships. You see this kid, you know, interacting with his father, with his mother. With himself, he's a very introspective young man. So that, to answer your question, that came later as I was trying to create the impetus for moving the story forward.
Hey, our guest this morning is P.K. Edgewater. He joins us from Oregon. The book is Passages, a novel, A Voyage from War to Peace. And one of the things about that I wondered as I was reading the book, and I don't know, I hope this will be a good positive for you. I sensed, PK, that your relationship with your mother and father must have been pretty special.
It was special for all of the siblings. My parents weren't wealthy. They weren't educated, but they had big hearts. They had, fabulous ethics. They had commitment to their family. I can't say enough about them. They were so generous with what they had, and the ways that they could be generous, that they left a mark on all of us to make a contribution.
Yeah. I wonder, there's a little piece in the book I wanted to read, because again, I mean, I pictured you through the book. I mean, this was your life. You have been Miko, my friend. To me. Yeah. And your mother in the book is Sophia, And there's a place where it talks about, as you've started living life and you've been through a lot of things, and it says, Sophia hesitated. As I said, she said, it is time to decide. I've left your room all the same since you left for university. All the things from your childhood. You should go through and see what is precious to you. If America is to be your new home, take them. Leave the rest to me. On the last morning, when your papa left me, he said I should go through your things soon. He knew I was missing you and feeling a bit sad, and maybe he thought it would help. What I was really feeling was sadness for your father, brave man struggling to work and protecting me from whatever may come. I have really been in no mood to go through your things. Despite all the chaos and his back pain, your papa had become, well, very calm. He didn't seem afraid of anything and didn't want me to worry. I could go on, but that particular type of scene that you, I thought you portrayed it so well. Wow. How many times has that type of experience between mother and son been played out? And that makes a book, you know, when there are those parts that no matter, you know, I don't have to, you know, be the things that Miko has been or is going to be, but there's a part like that, yeah, I connect to that. Yeah, I experienced that, or I wish I had experienced that. It's a specialty to writing. And you've got several of those in the book that portray that. How much, when you think back now, how much of that was by design to connect the reader to the reality, to make it seem real of what you're writing about in this novel?
Well, I'm so gratified that you find those passages that you've identified as meaningful. And that's the type of writing I wanted to do. I wanted to convey, you know, what I've witnessed among people who love each other, you know, parents, children, siblings. And, you know, it doesn't feel that difficult if you take the time, sit down, and think about what a conversation would look like, a conversation that carries those feelings. You know, you have to describe the person's body posture. You have to describe their facial expressions. You have to describe the tempo of their voice, because so much of our emotions that we express to each other are carried through all of those modalities, so to speak. And I certainly drew from my own relationships and from relationships that I witnessed among patients and their families, their spouses, their children, and vice versa. You know, a moment ago you talked about, you know, getting into some little space and have people read this and they would walk out and buy the book. That I couldn't have described my hope for this book any better. That when people sit down and think about what a conversation would look like in a certain relationship. Relationship, you know, when Costas goes to see his primary care doctor, what that's like from the patient's point of view and what it's like from the physician point of view. And I wanted people to experience that. You know, and another passage that I wanted people to experience is they get an idea of what, you know, a military recruit goes through in boot camp, in basic training. The atmosphere, and when someone is going through medical training, the stresses that come up, the people that they interact with, like the night nurses and so forth, all those things, I wanted to create images of those types of relationships that we often take for granted. We take the passage of those relationships, the arc of those relationships, we take them for granted. And it's so useful to us emotionally and cognitively to step back and think about the content of those relationships, how they started, how they formulated, and sometimes how they've ended. Those are the types of stories I'd like to convey.
Hmm. Major Sidney Friedman. No, I'm sorry. That's not, we don't have Sidney. It's PK Edgewater who's with us. Really. PK, how many, what percentage of your patients, and I don't know if you're going to give me a, you can give me a stock answer and I'll accept it. I don't want to.
Okay.
But what percentage of your patients did you, would you say that you formed a really special relationship with?
Wow, that's a tough question. You know, it's sort of tiered down. You know, if you look at practitioners of my subspecialty, we are looked at as two things. One, the expert who's going to determine what's actually happening with the patient in terms of what's causing their symptoms, what's causing their damage. And some of that is, you know, it takes one or two visits, one or two diagnostic visits. Well, you know, this is what is going on with you. It's really not in my specialty to manage long-term, but I can get you to the right place. There are some things that you can place in order very quickly and pass them back to their primary care physician. I would say about 40% of people became my long-term patients, those that I would need to manage for years or decades. And about half of those, about 20%, we would connect way beyond their medical issues that I was responsible for to a friendship. And I got to know their family, got to know about their family, their work, what was important to them. And, you know, it's not always, you know, this ache or pain that day or this, you know, abnormal urine or blood test. You know, it's what's happening in their lives and what am I doing that will help them address the other issues in their lives. I had discussions that people would, you know, would take to their minister because we had built such a trust over years that they felt they could lay anything at my doorstep. And I would give them honest answers, and their information would be protected. I can't think of anything that hasn't been laid at my doorstep at one time or another. And, you know, over time, you get used to fielding those deep, very personal questions and being able to step back for the patient and reflect on their viewpoint and try to show them maybe another viewpoint. And that's what is helpful that develops from experience. I know you know this. You've been an interlocutor for 50 years now. You know how to take people from one viewpoint to another. These sort of paradigm shifts that people experience when they're addressing challenges. They get wedged into one way of thinking or seeing the matter, and you can redirect them. So it's in those relationships that really took all of what I had, not just the, you know, anatomy and physiologic and pharmacologic knowledge, but just the knowledge of people, how they respond to things, what they need, how shifting their viewpoint is so helpful sometimes. And that's what made for a very rich and rewarding run as a doctor.
That was an, you made me feel like Colonel Sam Flagg. All right, there. that was such a good.
You see characters. You see characters everywhere. I know you appreciate that.
Again, our guest this morning is P.K. Edgewater. The name of the book, Passages, a Novel, A Voyage from War to Peace. It is it's not an overly long book, but it's long enough. I mean, it's over 200 pages. It just came out, fairly late last year?
Yes. Well, in July.
In July? Mm-hmm. This, you know, when you talk about putting together this kind of a book and a novel, and this is your first novel, right?
Yes, it's my first novel. All the rest of the writing I've done has been medical and technical.
So what?
Research-based.
How was the decision made? Oh, I think I'll write a novel. Just get up one morning and say, I think I'll write a novel.
You know, there's a kind of a two-part answer to that question. First of all, you may gather that I'm an odd duck. I was not a fiction reader during my career. If I had free time to read, I had my nose in, you know, the medical literature, the practice management literature, you know, global health, you know, and just learning about things related to my profession that I needed to know. But as I got towards the end of my career and thinking and planning, what would I do? I did look back on a lot of the rich experiences in my practices just with ordinary people who faced extraordinary challenges. And I got to witness them facing those challenges with courage and resilience. And I just imagined telling stories about those people. And that's what inspired me. The military thing is that, you know, I had quite a few vets and members of vets' families. So I decided I would think off from there and draw from my own family's experience with the issues that many vets faced. And so that's where it started.
Mm. Life changes us, doesn't it?
Why
did you feel it was important to include the wives of the main characters in the book, to bring them into the picture? What brought that about?
You know, many things, as you can imagine. The relationships with our significant others, whatever that relationship is built on, are important. And, you know, we sort of ground ourselves in those relationships as much, if not more, than our profession. So the playoff between individuals and their significant others is core to their happiness. It's core to their decision-making framework. And, you know, so many people who are facing challenges, you know, think about vets. The stresses that they bring home are going to be resonating through the lives of their spouses. So you can get to know people better when you meet their family or at least their significant other. So to understand in a very deep way, you have to drill down to their key relationships. So I thought it was important to flesh those out, at least as far as the wives and in some cases the children. So that gives a more rounded view of the character and, you know, brings in the opportunity to, in writing a novel, there's the scenes that you write where people are talking with each other and things are acting kinetically. And then there's the exposition where the writer is just telling the story, maybe from a, you know, an omnipotent third party view or from some other character's view. And you have to dip into those buckets of people's lives to really tell the story in a full and rich way.
How about this? What, you know, having been at the Air Force Academy and you wanted to be a pilot, obviously would like to have been, wonder in terms of from combat people, the PTSD effects on Air Force veterans versus Army veterans. Would it be somewhat similar, somewhat the same in the percentages of Air Force people that have suffer from PTSD who have been in combat versus the Army? Is there anything there that's worth even talking about?
Sure. Yeah. If you can imagine, in my imagination, those boots on the ground are the most exposed to the types of experiences that would inflict post-traumatic stress disorder. If you're conditioned to see horrendous things that we all naturally retract from, boots on the ground, you see most of that. In naval combat and in the Air Force, you know, you have more people in a support role for the ground activity. So just on a volume basis, they're less exposed. But, you know, PTSD can come from any sort of trauma. You may be the one that's just witnessed a car accident and, you know, seeing someone decapitated. My God, you know, think about the visualization of something like that, and you can't unsee that, as people say. That could be as big a provocateur as being in war. So we know a lot about the pathology and management of PTSD. The manifestations can be quite debilitating. There are individualized mental health recovery programs for vets returning from conflict, and that's mostly going to be Army, Marines, and where necessary, Air Force and Navy.
Well,
the burden of disease in the public is pretty much underserved.
The element of the book that at the end that stands out to me really is it's going to make the reader think more deeply about their relationships, past relationships, present relationships, possibility of future relationships, what those relationships really mean to the overall picture of life. Does that fall within the frame of reference that you have for what people should get out of it, or what do you want them to get out of it?
Dan, I think you've said it well. You picked up on the core of the book. I'm hoping that people will read the novel and, you know, visualize some experience they've had in the book or with one of these characters. But mostly I'm hoping that they'll step back and take some introspection about their passages, the relationships that they've had with their parents, with their siblings, with their training in whatever way, with things that have happened in the course of their career. Step back, you know, and try to assess, what did I learn from that? Not just the rote learning that came from books or lectures, but what did the experience do to me in terms of how I see the world, how my emotional responses are formed now, both for the good and for the bad. And why, if it's for the bad, how did I come to be that way? And then look for alternatives. You know, people often harbor regrets about things, and they can't go back and change the history in their life, but they can certainly, as it's talked about in the book, they can certainly put things in a different room in their minds, and just hold them there and say, okay, this was a tough time, and this affected me badly, or this affected me in a good way. What can I learn about looking back at that and taking the lessons from it as I go forward? And it's all about going forward despite the damage done.
Mm. PK, we haven't talked about your immediate family that much, the book, because we're running out of time. But what about the publication of this book? How did you get it into print? Was it hard?
It wasn't that hard. I chose, I'm an old guy and I'm a new novel writer. I am not going to be picked up by any of the big four or five publishers. So I had very successful people around me whose habit was self-publication. And there are so many pathways to doing that. Now, that's the path I took. In my neighborhood, I had writers of genre fiction, of historical, nonfiction, and poetry. And I got some good lessons and got some really good guidance to get published. Anyone can publish nowadays.
Yeah. How do people get a hold of passages?
Probably the easiest way is going to a bookstore and asking for it. They can order it for you. It can be printed very quickly and by a company called Ingram Spark. They can go on Amazon and find it. If you Google it, you'll probably find many ways to pick it up.
Well, it's I will recommend it to the listeners out there as a book that you will enjoy. You'll be caught up into the elements of what's happening. You will live through Miko and the other characters. It'll cause a lot of thinking to go on for you when you read this book, and when you read it, you can go through and you can decide if you really think that PK Edgewater, is he like Benjamin Franklin, Hawkeye Pierce, or Wayne Rogers, or Trapper John McGuire, or maybe he moves up to a McLean Stevenson or a Henry Blake. I don't know,
there
but
you go.
I think at the end you'll agree with me, and you will see Major Sidney Friedman in your mind, and as he's a lot smarter than all those other guys. They may be good surgeons, but good old Sidney is his thought processes are way above those other guys. Do you have a dog?
Indeed. Well,
do you have a dog?
Do I have a dog? No, we lost our dog a couple of years back, and we haven't had the heart to get another one.
We had
a blue tick coonhound.
Oh,
wow.
A blue tick
coonhound. A floppy ear, long nose, howling. His name was Howie because he, of the howling. Just the sweetest dog in the world.
Well,
how about you?
Oh, we have a little Shih Tzu. He rules the roost. He's only about two and a half. I mean, when he gets to be five, I mean, I'll probably have to put a trailer out back and move into that, cause he'll be running everything. He won't even let me, life is better with dogs. I hope you can, we're in small town America here. We're close to,
sure,
close to Lexington, but this is small town America. In our county clerk, he has this beautiful, beautiful dog, and he's a golden retriever. Yeah. And Rondo, he brings him right into the studio. He's in here this morning. Well, he's wandering around the back right now. He'll come back in, and he'll just come up and he'll lay his face right in the palm of my hand. And I mean, he's the friendliest dog that you could possibly find. And anyway, yep. That's the reason I bring that up. I always think, you know, because I've discovered life is better with dogs, because we had a dog that laid down in the middle of the street, a beautiful Cocker Spaniel, when I was small. On a Sunday morning, the preacher ran over. Our pastor ran over accidentally, and she just had puppies.
That's tragic. And it
kind of broke my dad's heart, and we never had a dog again. I just don't think he could bear it.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, I was much later in life before I ever got another dog, but I do. I spread the word. Life is better with dogs, I think.
Well, it is, and there's medical evidence for that. You know, oodles of research experience with our pets.
Where in Oregon are you exactly?
So if you can think about the Oregon coast, we're about halfway down. We're on the central coast level, and we're in the middle of Lincoln County, and Depot Bay is sort of in the middle of Lincoln County. We're just right in the middle of the coastal span of Oregon.
And if I'm new to the area, I do not want to be headed north to south on Highway 1, do I? I would rather be going from south to north, right? I can enjoy the ride a lot better.
I'm not biased in that way. I go up and down the highway all the time, and it's beautiful both directions.
Well, but I say that because I feel like I'm going to end up in the Pacific Ocean sometimes when I'm going north to south. You know, I don't know. I tell people that all the time, man. When you go, if you're going to go to California, you're going to travel, go the southern route and then go up Highway 1 that way, enjoy it.
Yeah.
And then come back the northern route.
Yeah.
It's
great. It's a great drive. It just takes you across some of our beautiful America.
Hey.
PK, we all live in a great country.
Yeah, we do, don't we? PK Edgewater, I wish we had more time. It's been really fun to visit. Maybe write another book, okay?
I'll do it. Thanks, Dan. You've been a gem.
Hey.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Hope people will pick up Passages. We'll be back after we take a break from the CBS News here on Boys on Main. There's something back there that you love.
106.9 FM and AM 1150 WMST Mount Sterling. CBS News Time. This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Deborah Rodriguez. The Jeffrey Epstein scandal is front and center today on both sides of the Atlantic.